Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. I have been following this case for a very, very long time, and last week there was a major and somewhat shocking development. This case caught my attention over a decade ago because the man at the center of it is very similar to a certain group of people I grew up around, and they're people I've come to have a real distaste for, and you'll find out why. One late fall afternoon in Kalamazoo County, Michigan, two hunters were found dead on the floor of the forest. And that's just about the only thing people who know about this case can agree on. The facts are not entirely clear, and the rumor and innuendo is out of control. This is the story of the murders of Doug Estes and James Bennett. It's a story about a serial killer in the area, and it's a story about the man authorities are convinced committed the murders. This is the story of Jeff Titus and the Deer Hunter murders. Let's get into it.
Susan!
Welcome out.
Oh, thank
you. Oh,
I owe you so much. It's
so
good to see you. You saw that picture?
I did.
It just changed everything for my whole case. And you turned around and seen that picture.
Get up here.
Of Thomas Dillon. And the police had that file.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes,
thank you for coming in.
Your dad.
Thank you.
Yes.
This is the right thing. Thank you.
Yeah, and then Ken, he turned around, did my case 5 years ago in 10 days on my birthday, February 15th to 17th. You did that whole thing on my case, and I appreciate you for it. Yes, it's good. I've been doing an awful lot of trying. I've been in there just a shaking, and I thought maybe it was going to happen again today. Been sitting in there making cards. That's all I've been doing. Occupy time, stay out of trouble and everything. And I got tens of thousands of cards I made.
As you saw there, Jeff Titus has just been released from prison after spending 22 years incarcerated for a crime that he swears he did not commit. When I tell you there is division in this case, division, that word doesn't really give an accurate portrayal of how strongly investigators and prosecutors are divided on this. It's more like a holy war. Two sets of detectives investigated this double murder. One set believes Jeff Titus is innocent, and one set believes that he is guilty as sin. But even that has now come into question. So what I'm going to do today is tell the story from the beginning, simply by laying out the facts, and you will have to decide for yourself what you believe. So let's start on the day of the murders. November 17th, 1990. It is deer hunting season. Those of you who, like I do, live in a big hunting area know that usually during deer hunting season, you'll hear about accidental shootings, hunters who are shot by other hunters in the area. It's an unfortunate occurrence, but it is not uncommon for hunters to be shot by other hunters during hunting season. A call comes into the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Department. At first, it sounds as if that's exactly what has happened. There has been an accidental shooting. But as the caller continues and the dispatcher takes down notes, it becomes clear. Two hunters have been shot in the woods in Kalamazoo County, but it was no accident. These two men have been murdered, shot at very close range. They are Doug Estes and James Bennett. The men are lying dead about 15 feet apart, and both of them had cowardly been shot in the back. Now, you would initially think that these two men were friends or hunting partners, as I did when I first heard about the shooting, but you'd be wrong, just like I was. These two men did not know each other. They were not hunting partners, and after the murders, police tried for years to find any link between the two men, and they never did. These were just two hunters who went into the woods separately and never came out. Now, this was in a state game area. I don't know what the rules are for that particular area, but in some state game areas, you're not allowed to hunt at all. In other places, you have to have a permit to hunt that area. So these two men had gone in to hunt for deer, and now they were laying on the cold forest floor. They were found by Doug Estes' 18-year-old stepson, Bobby Brown. Bobby and his stepfather, Doug, went into the forest together, but had split up to hunt individually. Bobby heard shots coming from the area where he had last seen Doug. He went back to that area and found not only his stepfather, but James Bennett as well, both dead on the forest floor. Bobby was totally distraught. He was crying, he was shaking, and it was clear that he was very upset over the shooting and the death of his stepfather. So right off the bat, the detectives believed him. He was just too shaken up to not be believed. Very quickly, the detectives who were called to the scene realized something. James Bennett's rifle was lying here, right next to his body. But Doug Estes' hunting rifle was nowhere to be found. It made the police believe that the missing weapon could be the murder weapon and that the shooter took it with him so it could not be linked to him, so that had he left some sort of DNA on it or something like that, it couldn't be traced. The shooter had also picked up all of the spent shells at the crime scene, and investigators didn't find a single casing, so they knew that this killer was somebody who was meticulous and he was somebody that was aware of forensic techniques that might be used by the police. On the same day that Doug Estes and James Bennett were out hunting, this man, Jeff Titus, and this man, his friend, Stan Driscoll, were hunting as well. Jeff Titus owned a large parcel of property that bordered the Fulton State game area. Now, this is where I'm going to talk a little bit about the type of man that Jeff Titus is. Landowners do not like it when hunters come on their property without permission. No landowner likes that. My best friend Travis owns a large ranch on Cedar Mountain, and year after year, I hear stories about how he and other landowners up there catch people hunting on their property who aren't supposed to be there. They tell them to leave, and that's that. But then you have people like Jeff Titus. Jeff Titus was one of those, like, this my land, you know, type of guys, like those type of guys that watch Red Dawn a little too much and take it just a little too seriously. These kinds of people are often really crotchety, miserable human beings. They're not fun to be around, and they don't have a lot of friends. Jeff Titus would constantly tell people that if he ever caught anyone on his property, hunting or not, he would shoot them. He would talk about how he had every right to do that and how he wasn't worried about jail time because as a landowner, he was entitled to shoot trespassers. I mean, that's really stupid. You cannot shoot someone just because they're trespassing. That is ridiculous. But this is the type of person Jeff Titus was back then. On the day the bodies were found, November 17, 1990, Jeff Titus and his friend Stan Driscoll were hunting about 30 miles away from where the murders took place. They finished hunting for the day, and then they got back to Jeff Titus's farm at about 7 o'clock that evening. As the two hunters approached the farmhouse, they could see the police lights from the investigation glowing in the background, and then a policeman stopped the two hunters and told them they couldn't go any further. Well, Jeff Titus immediately got an attitude with the officer and said, "Who are you to tell me what I can do on my property?" Jeff then got out of the car and told Stan, "I'm going to go talk to this officer," and he walked away and the two of them spoke privately. Apparently, Jeff Titus then calmed down and told the officers that he would allow access to the shooting site through his property. So I don't know what the police officer said to him, but Jeff Titus decided to cooperate. But then Jeff did something strange. He asked the officer, whose name was Russ Richards, "Did someone get murdered?" He didn't say, "Was there an accident?" He didn't say, "Did someone get shot?" He specifically said, "Did someone get murdered?" One of the initial detectives spent the days following the murders talking to all of the residents in the area about the shootings. All of the witnesses who heard the gunshots described hearing two shots very close together. They described them as boom, boom. Many of the witnesses also reported hearing a car kind of spinning its wheels and then driving away just after the gunshots. Well, that car ended up in a ditch near a county road intersection. This woman, Helen Knobs, saw the car speeding away and she saw it go into the ditch where it got stuck. So Helen left her house and she walked to the car and saw that it was a hatchback. There was some minor damage to the car and the man in it said he needed help getting unstuck. So Helen said she would go back to her house and call the police. No cell phones at this time. And the man in the car told her, "No, I don't want the police here." Helen later said the man was nervous and upset and sweating profusely. He was also wearing camouflage. As Helen stood talking to the man, a black truck pulled up and offered to help. And so this man used his truck to pull the man out of the ditch. And Helen just got in her car and went home. The most important part of this encounter, Helen said the man in the car was not Jeff Titus, and Helen would know. She was Jeff's neighbor. She knew Jeff Titus. So clear back in 1990, this gave the original investigators, the original set of investigators, more proof that there was another person in the area, and Helen Knobs even created this sketch of the man she had seen in the car. It's a pretty good sketch. It's better than some of the police artist sketches that we've seen from the past, right? The police circulated the sketch around, but nobody ever came forward with information. Not even the truck driver that pulled the stuck car out of the ditch came forward. At the time that the car was stuck in the ditch, of course, nobody realized how important that was going to become in the future. Then, just 2 days after the murders, Jeff Titus calls, not the police, but the local news station, and tells them that he has found a second weapon near the crime scene. This angers the police and makes them very suspicious. Why would Jeff Titus call the news and not them? And what is he doing wandering around the crime scene looking for evidence? The police and the public found this very, very odd behavior. But Jeff was kind of an odd guy. The news station actually had to be the ones to alert the police of this weapon. Later on, this behavior would turn out to be a very, very bad choice for Jeff Titus. He would later say he liked the idea of getting his name in the paper, and that's why he had called the paper. Well, he got his name in the paper, all right, many, many times after this. The gun was collected by the police, and Doug Estes' family members confirmed it was the gun that Doug Estes used for hunting. It was the gun that was missing at the initial crime scene, and Jeff Titus had found it. There was a big problem. The site where the gun was found had been searched on the day of the murders over and over and over. Several police officers even verified that they had been to the exact spot where the gun had been found, and it had not been there. As you can see, the gun is clearly visible in the leaves. You'd see it if you were just walking through the forest, let alone searching a crime scene. So at this point in time, many people began to believe that Jeff Titus had planted the weapon there. But of all people, the original detectives were still not convinced. They readily admit that it was dark when they searched the crime scene and that they were using flashlights. And apparently, they hadn't gone back to the scene in the daylight, which seems like a bad choice to me. But at any rate, the original detectives do not believe the gun was planted. They simply believe they missed it on the night of the murders. Here, however, is something that everyone finds very, very suspicious. Doug Estes' gun, first missing and then found, did not have a single fingerprint on it. Not even Doug Estes' own fingerprints were on it. So at that point in time, it became really clear that someone had intentionally wiped the gun of all fingerprints. The gun undergoes forensic testing, and the results are inconclusive. It cannot be determined whether or not Doug Estes' gun is the murder weapon. Remember, this was 1990. They didn't have the techniques that they have now. Investigators then invite Jeff Titus into the police department for an interview, and he accepts. He reiterates his story. He says he and Stan were hunting. They didn't know anything about the shootings until they pulled onto Jeff's farm and saw the lights of the police cars in the distance. Jeff tells police that if they want to, they can speak with his neighbors, the Shepherds, who live in a farmhouse near Jeff's property. The police do go and speak with the Shepherds, and they confirm they saw Jeff Titus that day. He had stopped at their house and had coffee with them, and then he went out hunting. Jeff and Stan came back with a deer in the bed of the pickup truck, and Jeff said he was going to take it home and butcher it. Most of what Jeff Titus was telling the police was adding up. But during the interview, the police ask him if he wants to take a polygraph test, and Jeff agrees. Now, you all know how I feel about polygraph tests. I feel they're junk science, and I don't think anyone should take one. Regardless, Jeff Titus takes the polygraph, and he passes with flying colors. In late 1990, the original detectives on the case officially cleared Jeff Titus for the double murders. The investigators do not believe he is their shooter. Then the Kalamazoo detectives are contacted by authorities in Ohio and are informed they have a serial killer who is stalking, hunting, and shooting hunters in the woods there. So this was, of course, very interesting to the Michigan detectives. Which serial killer are we talking about? This man, who I'm sure many of you have heard of, Thomas Lee Dillon. Thomas Lee Dillon was eventually convicted of shooting and killing five men who were all hunting or fishing at the times of their murders. We will cover him on another episode, but this is, like I said, very interesting to the Kalamazoo detectives, and they believe there is a great possibility that Thomas Lee Dillon crossed state lines and killed Doug Estes and James Bennett. Another thing, Thomas Lee Dillon looks very much like the man in Helen Knopf's sketch. The police go back to Helen, and she confirms that yes, she believes he was the man she saw stuck in the car in the ditch on that day. Investigators then put Thomas Lee Dillon in a lineup, and they bring Helen Knobs in to view it. She immediately identifies Thomas Lee Dillon as the man she saw stuck in the ditch on the day of the murders. So now the police are at a standstill. They have ruled out their only suspect, and they have absolutely nothing else to go on. For 12 years, the case goes unsolved, and then it is turned over to two new detectives, two cold case detectives, and it quickly becomes the subject of great controversy in Kalamazoo, Michigan. 2002. The unsolved and very, very cold case murders of Douglas Estes and James Bennett is reopened and turned over to two new detectives. These two new detectives are convinced that Jeff Titus is the killer. They begin to build a case against Jeff Titus based on several things. One, he had a long established history of not only confronting people who walked on his property, but wielding a gun at them. So, of course, that doesn't look great, but that isn't the big thing. On the night of the crime, the two initial investigating officers cleared Jeff Titus of any involvement because he was with Stan Driscoll the entire day and evening. And then on top of that, the initial investigating officers had found Jeff Titus accommodating and cooperative after he was initially brusque with them, and they didn't believe his attitude was in line with someone who would be hiding something. But the problem was that Jeff Titus had been running his mouth over the years since the murders. And I mean running his mouth. Jeff had been openly telling people in town that he had killed the two hunters. One night, a woman in a bar asked him, "Did you kill those two men?" And Jeff Titus smirked at her and said, "Probably." And he laughed. He also told people that earlier in the day, he had been in a confrontation with Doug Estes and James Bennett, and that the two men, quote, had an attitude problem and I understand why they were killed. Jeff Titus told others, I'm glad those two are dead. They deserved it. The cold case detectives then found a local citizen who told them Jeff Titus once said, one of those guys tried to crawl away from me. They never figured out that his wallet is missing. Another local then comes forward and tells cold case investigators that Jeff Titus told him, I shot those guys at close range. I was so close that the wadding from the shotgun is in their bodies. All of that is true. It's all true, and it's information that has never been released to the public until very recently. Jeff Titus was running his mouth, and Jeff Titus' own words convinced the cold case detectives that he was their man. The two cold case detectives read about the car in the ditch, and they are adamant that the man who got his car stuck in the ditch has nothing to do with the shootings. They say that's just a coincidence that someone got their car stuck at the same time the shootings occurred. I watched interviews with these two cold case detectives, and the reasons that they gave for believing this were things like, maybe that guy was sweating and nervous because he had just come from cheating on his wife. Maybe he had just stolen a rabbit off someone's property. Those kinds of statements are very disturbing in a formal investigation because they're conjecture. These cops are literally just making things up and using them as some kind of evidence. They don't even know who the man in the car was. So how can they be so sure he had nothing to do with the shootings? And why would they just be pulling excuses out of the air for this unidentified man? I don't think conjecture belongs in an investigation, and I certainly don't think detectives should go on TV and say things that they have no evidence for. These two cold case detectives team up with this prosecutor, and together they decide that Jeff Titus has been getting away with murder, and they go after him, guns blazing. These new cold case detectives and the prosecutor they're working with are totally convinced that Jeff is the killer, and they're a little indignant as to why he hasn't been arrested. They bring in their local FBI agent and ask that the behavioral science team draft a profile of the killer. The profile they get back states, the killer will have a military background. Jeff Titus was in the Marines. It states that the killer will be an expert marksman and an avid hunter. Jeff Titus was. It says the shooter will be fiercely protective of his property, and we already know Jeff Titus was that and then some. The profile then goes on to state that the murderer would be a man who loves to kill and would kill animals often, would skin animals often, and would field dress his own animals. All of those elements in the FBI profile apply directly to Jeff Titus. Problem is, most of them also apply to Thomas Lee Dillon, the serial killer that these cold case detectives didn't even know about during their cold case investigation. We'll talk more about that in a second. The FBI then goes one step further and tells the cold case detectives, it is the opinion of their agency and of the agents that have reviewed the case that Jeff Titus is their shooter. Then there is a bombshell. Jeff Titus' neighbor comes forward and informs the police that he has been keeping a secret he has decided to tell. This neighbor says Jeff Titus told him that he found the gun in the woods and that he wanted to make the police look stupid. So he took the gun home and cleaned it. He took it apart, cleaned it thoroughly, wiped it of all fingerprints, of course, including his own. And then this story is verified by not only another neighbor, but three other neighbors. So there's no question at this point. Jeff Titus has been telling people he took the gun home and cleaned it. That would definitely explain why there were no fingerprints on the gun, not even its owners. The cold case detectives then decide to look into Jeff's alibi. Now, he's got two alibis, actually. He's got Stan, his best friend, who says they were together all day. And then they've got the Shepherd family, who lives on the farm next to Jeff's property. The Shepherds gave a statement saying Jeff and Stan were at their house for the majority of the day, and then they left to go hunting before sunset. If you don't hunt, deer bed down towards dusk, and so that's a really good time to go hunting for them. If you're not familiar with deer hunting, they bed down in the grasses that they've prepared as their little beds, and they will go back to those places as it starts to get dark. So if you can find the deer beds, you wait for them there, and that's a good place to hunt. So Stan and Jeff were going to go out a little before dusk to wait by some deer beds. The cold case detectives read the single paragraph written by the Shepherds and dismiss it because it simply says he was here in the day and then he left. Jeff and Stan left well before the shootings, so the statement by the Shepherds didn't really mean anything to the cold case detectives. Then the cold case detectives are blown away to find out that in all of the years since the double murder, Stan Driscoll has never been contacted by the police. The original officers never spoke to the man who claimed to be with Jeff Titus all day. So this investigation was very, very shoddy, to say the least. The original officers now claim they should have spoken with Stan, but that at the time, because they had cleared Jeff Titus, it didn't seem important to them. Speaking with a suspected murderer's alibi, you'd think would always be at the very top of the to-do list for the detectives, right? Stan Driscoll then tells the cold case detectives, the first cops he's ever talked to, that as they were hunting, there were several times during the day that he and Jeff split up. The most notable time being from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. that evening. Did you just hear that? The original detectives had dismissed Jeff Titus as a suspect simply because he said he was with Stan Driscoll. Not only had they never interviewed Stan, Stan was now telling the cold case detectives that he was not with Jeff Titus at the time of the murders. They were apart for 2 hours, the most critical time of the entire case. I mean, I always want to think the best about our police officers. I do, because I truly believe that most of them are good people. I know some of you disagree with me. And I believe from watching the interviews with these original detectives that they are good people. I just have to wonder what they were thinking. And after 15 years at this point in time, Jeff Titus's alibi has just been shot to hell. Oh, that was not the best choice of words. Cold case detectives gather statement after statement from witnesses in the area who have not just been run off of Jeff's property, but have had guns pointed at them and had their lives threatened. Jeff Titus had only owned the property for a very short time. This property was like his new baby, and he was very, very proud of it. And Jeff Titus is not someone who wants to share. Cold case detectives then obtained a warrant for Jeff Titus's property. And as they went to Jeff Titus's house to execute the warrant, Jeff Titus gets out a lawn chair, sets up a lawn chair, and pulls out a John Grisham novel and sits down, cracks open a beer, and starts leisurely reading a book as the cops investigate him for murder 15 years later. When the police first arrived at the house, one of them asked Jeff, "Do you know why we're here?" And Jeff said to them, "Yeah, you're hoping I'll slip up." So this guy is not doing himself any favors at all. As the search of Jeff's home continues, investigators find 3 shell casings in a little plastic baggie, a pair of camouflage pants tucked in a bag, and pretty much every single news article ever printed on the murders cut out and placed in an envelope. And by the way, the shotgun shells they found inside that little plastic baggie, they were the exact shell casings from bullets that Doug Estes' gun took. So at this point, it is really looking like Jeff Titus killed the 2 men, took the gun from the murder scene, took it home, cleaned it, picked up all the shell casings, and kept them all these years. For a decade, the cold case detectives investigated, and then they felt they finally had everything they needed. They finalized putting a case together, they have the support of the prosecutor, and with that, it's time to go and pick up Jeff Titus. December 12th, 2001. Cold case detectives arrive at Jeff Titus' home with a warrant for his arrest. He is taken into custody, and Jeff later tells reporters, "I was in complete shock. I knew they had nothing on me, and I couldn't believe what was happening. They put me in leg chains and belly chains, trying to embarrass me." That's another one of Jeff Titus's statements where you really see who he is. It's like, bro, you're being arrested for a double murder, and you're worried about being embarrassed? Just a man with a very big ego. After Jeff Titus was arrested, more people began to come forward. Bonnie Huffman, a neighbor of Jeff Titus at the time of the murders, calls the police and tells them that in 1990, she saw Jeff Titus at about 9 o'clock on the night of the killings. But then Bonnie changes her story and says it wasn't 9 o'clock. It was actually more like 6:30. That would destroy both Jeff Titus and the Shepherd's statements that Jeff was just leaving the Shepherd house around dusk to go hunting. Bonnie Huffman's house is about as close to the murder scene as you can get. So now detectives feel that Bonnie saw Jeff leaving the crime scene. The cold case detectives and the prosecutors then rely heavily on Bonnie Huffman's story, even though her story had drastically changed from the night of the murders to the time of Jeff's arrest. Stan Driscoll, Jeff's hunting partner, then states that Bonnie could not have seen Jeff between 6 and 6:30, and he can prove it. Stan pulls out his cell phone records and shows cops that he and Jeff were at a Burger King drive-thru, that they were together, and that Stan had called his wife at the time while they were sitting in the drive-thru. With all of this conflicting and differing evidence, Jeff Titus goes on trial. A jury of his peers finds him guilty of 2 first-degree murders, and he is sentenced to life in prison. In 2002, Jeff files this appeal, which is denied. Jeff Titus sits in prison for 1 decade and then 2, but as he does, his case starts to garner attention. Then a cellmate of Thomas Lee Dillon's, the serial killer, contacts authorities and tells them that while in prison, Thomas Lee Dillon had nonchalantly told him the story of the double murder. This cellmate claims that Thomas Lee Dillon said he was walking through the woods when he came upon 2 hunters who were talking together in the woods. He walked up to them and the 3 men visited for a moment, and then Thomas Lee Dillon says he raised his gun and shot the 2 men dead. This information, along with new statements and a review of the police work, which was, you know, motivated the Michigan Innocence Clinic to take up Jeff Titus's case, and they began to fight to get him released from prison. At the same time, podcasters and true crime shows began covering the case. In one of the several shows that I watched to prepare to write this episode, it was filmed well after Jeff Titus's conviction, the documentarian asks the 2 cold case detectives, "Are you aware that there was a serial killer operating in the area at the time of the murders?" To my shock and horror, they both said, "No, we weren't aware of that." Now, hello, I'm not a cop. I don't know how their documentation process works. But shouldn't that have been not only noted in the file, but have been a large portion of the file? That there was a serial killer in the area killing deer hunters. How was that not in the file? How on earth could the 2 original detectives have done a lineup, brought in a witness who identified a serial killer, and none of that is in the cold case file for the cold case detectives to see? This blew me away, and I'd really like to know more information on it if anyone has it, because it's very disturbing. As the cold case detectives look at the information that has just been shown to them by this documentarian, the TV producer, their reactions are very, very different. One of them says, "Well, this is interesting. This is a good example of the obstacles we encounter. This should have been documented." And the other one is just instantly defensive and adamant that Jeff Titus is the killer. The particular show I'm talking about is several years old and was filmed before the update of Jeff Titus being released from prison. But I found the 2 different responses from the detectives very interesting. Some people never ever can wrap their mind around the fact that they might be wrong. That particular documentary ends with the prosecutor and one of the cold case detectives saying, "Jeff Titus will never get out of prison. He's a guilty man and he will die there. He will never be released." Oh, how wrong they were. February 24th, 2023. Jeff Titus is released from prison, as you saw in the footage at the beginning of this episode. He fought a long and difficult uphill battle, and his attorneys and supporters accomplished something that happens very, very rarely. They freed a convicted killer. His conviction has been overturned by a federal judge whose opinion is that there is not enough evidence, and never was, to convict Jeff Titus of murder. After 22 years in prison, Jeff Titus was set free. He was released to the care of his family, and he celebrated by eating a Sweetwater's donut, a New York cheesecake donut to be exact, something he had missed greatly during his incarceration. Jeff Titus is convinced that serial killer Thomas Lee Dillon is the actual murderer, and he now spends his own time sitting outside, hunting deer, and drawing. It's now been 33 years since the murders of Doug Estes and James Bennett, and as of now, the case remains unsolved. I'm not going to tell you what I think about this one, but I have a lot of thoughts about both sides. If you want an example of a horribly investigated and handled case, look no further. But if you want an example of the perfect suspect who fit the FBI profile to a T and who even bragged about the multiple murders to multiple people, look no further. What I want to know is what you think. Is Jeff Titus an innocent man? Were the 2 decades he spent in prison a terrible miscarriage of justice? Or was a murderer just set free simply because of the incredible timing of being in the same vicinity as a serial killer with a similar MO? Who is Jeff Titus? Very unlucky outdoorsman or cold-blooded killer? Let me know. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. You know the drill. Hit the like button, subscribe to my channel if you want to see more from me, and of course you can join my Patreon. The ultimate goal there is to raise money to donate to police departments that have cold case DNA in storage that cannot be tested because there is no money to test it. We want to help with that. So find me on Patreon. It's Dining with Death. Thank you so much for watching, my friends. Your support means the world to me. Stay safe and be kind to each other. And I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.